Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, June 18th, 2001. In the fireside room this evening, there is Richard Rehoboam. Today's session is 2001, and it's titled A Sense of Place. Let's listen in.
The first thing I'm going to do is get your attention.
You have.
Wait a minute.
What can we do now?
Here we go. All right, this is just an exercise to kick this off. It's an exercise on observation, on focus. I'm going to recite a poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins called Inversnaid. Gerard Manley Hopkins was a Catholic priest. I forget which order. He spent a good deal of his career in Wales. And while in Wales, he became attuned to the traditional Welsh poetry, which goes all the way back to the kind of rhyme schemes and alliteration that was used in Beowulf. And he developed a poetic style which was far ahead of its time, at the same time that it went all the way back to Beowulf's time, which he called sprung rhythm. So I want you to listen to this poem. Listen for the alliterations, listen for internal rhymes, and also listen to the sense of the poem. And don't concentrate on my juggling. This darksome burn, horseback brown, his roll rock, high road, roaring down in coop and in comb, the fleece of his foam flutes, and low to the lake falls home. A windpuff bonnet of fawn froth turns and twindles over the broth of a pool so pitch black, fell frowning, it rounds and rounds despair to drowning. Degged with dew, dappled with dew, are the groins of the braes that the brook treads through. Wiry heath packs, flitches of fern, and the bead bonny ash that sits over the burn. What would the world be, once bereft of wet and of wildness? Let them be left, oh, let them be left, wildness and wet. Long live the weeds and the wilderness yet. So, my theme today is a sense of place. Where the hell are we? Where have we been? Where are we going? In space and in time, in micro scale, in macro scale, in nano scale, and in gigascale. All those words, nana, giga, we didn't have them before the 20th century, and now they're in common currency. They're not all Greek either, I discovered. I checked on the etymologies. As you get smaller, you lose the Greek. Milla, in fact, for thousandth, or 10 to the minus 3 for the mathematically inclined, milla is from Latin. But then you get to micro, and that's Greek for small. And then from micro, which is for 1 million, which would be 10 to the minus 6, you get to nano, and that's a billionth. And then beyond nano, and a billionth is 10 to the minus 9, you get to pico. Oh, nano comes from Greek also. It's for dwarf. And then pico comes from Spanish. And in Spanish, pico is just a little bit. It's also the beak of a bird and the peak of a mountain, but in this case, it means just a little bit. And then you get to femto. And femto, you'll be happy to hear, is Norwegian. Or Danish. Actually, it's probably Danish, and it probably is Danish because of Niels Bohr, the physicist. Because who in the world else needs to use a term for 10 to the minus 15? That's a quadrillion. One quadrillionth. It's very, very small, but physicists look at the very, very small. And that's femto. Femto comes from the Danish Norwegian for 15. So clearly this came from a physicist mathematician. Okay, going up the other way, we've got, as we get from, well, to 1,000, we're with Greek again, kilo. You know, when it's 1,000th, it's Latin milla, but if it's 1,000, then it's going to be Greek kilo. Above that, you're probably familiar with it if you use a computer, is mega, which is millions. That's also Greek. It means huge. It means big. Then you get giga. Giga, you know, I have this written down. I'm going to have to refer to my notes. I'll come back. Okay. Yeah, giga is Greek for giant. And the last one is also Greek, tera. We're talking now about terabytes of data in the computer world. And that's Greek for monster. And I guess many people would endorse that. Anyway, those are scales of the very small and the very large. And those are scales in which we dwell. In fact, they extend in both directions to infinity and beyond. And they're important. Well, you can always add one to infinity.
And one is that, and one is that, and one is that.
Exactly. My point exactly. Thank you. But to understand natural processes, we need to look not just at scale, but also at process itself. It's not something static, fixed in time or in space. Everything is moving, dynamic. The Greek philosopher Heraclitus said you can never step twice into the same stream. It's all in flux. It's all changing. So when we try to take stock of where we are in the universe or in creation, we need to look at the four scales that we can apprehend with our common sense, which is length, width, height, and place and time. And then we have to look at the process over time of all of those things, because they're all moving independently through time. I'm going to read the first lesson now. And this is from Annie Dillard's Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. Annie Dillard has since written a book that I think is in the library called The Living. She's written a lot of other books in between. But The Living is much more austere. She wrote this when she was quite young and not too long out of school. And she was excited about the natural world. And her prose evinces the excitement that she felt. And this is just to take this abstraction and put it into the real world. With the naked eye, I can see 2 million light years to the Andromeda Galaxy. Often I slop some creek water in a jar, and when I get home, I dump it in a white china bowl. After the silt settles, I return and see tracings of minute scales on the bottom. A planarian or two, that's a flatworm, winding around the rim of water. Roundworms shimmying frantically, and finally, when my eyes have adjusted to these dimensions, amoebae. At first, the amoebae look like those curled moving spots you seem to see in your eyes when you stare at a distant wall. Then I see the amoebae as drops of water, congealed, bluish, translucent, like chips of sky in the bowl. At length, I choose one individual and give myself over to its idea of an evening. I see it dribble a grainy foot before it on its wet, unfathomable way. Do its unedited sense impressions include the fierce focus of my eyes? Shall I take it outside and show it Andromeda and blow its little endoplasm? So she's looking at things in terms of the micro and the cosmic. And I think that any good naturalist is going to end up doing that sooner or later. We all tend to focus on our specific disciplines, but as we mature, I think we take a more expansive view of things and can hardly fail to if we're to excel at our own peculiar disciplines. And the second reading, which I'm going to run right into, is a little longer, but it's really like reading you a story. In fact, it's exactly like reading you a poem by Gary Snyder. This is from his book, Mountains and Rivers Without End, which I'm also pleased to say is both in the bookstore and in the library. And I recommend it highly. It's a book he worked on for decades. Really, it's a lifetime work of his. And I'll let the poem speak for itself. Old wood rat stinky house. The whole universe is an ocean of dazzling light. On it dance the waves of life and death, a service for the spirits of the dead. Coyote and Earthmaker, whirling about in the world winds, found a meadowlark nest floating and drifting, stretched it to cover the waters, and made us an earth. Us critters hanging out together something like 3 billion years. 300-something million years, the solar system swings around with all the Milky Way. Ice ages come 150 million years apart, last about 10 million. Then warmer days return. A venerable desert wood rat nest of twigs and shreds, plastered down with amber urine, a family house in use 8,000 years, and 4,000 years of using writing equals the life of a bristlecone pine. A spoken language works for about 5 centuries, lifespan of a Douglas fir. Big floods. Big fires every couple hundred years. A human life lasts 80, a generation 20. Hot summers every 8 or 10, 4 seasons every year, 28 days for the moon, day, night, the 24 hours. And a song might last 4 minutes. A breath is a breath. All this in 5,086 coyote scats. Pocket gopher, elk calf, deer, field mouse, snowshoe hare, ground squirrel, jackrabbit, deer mouse, pine squirrel, beaver, jumping mouse, chipmunk, wood rat, pika, house cat, flying squirrel, duck, jay, owl, grebe, fish, snake, grasshopper, cricket, grass, pine nuts, rose seeds, mushrooms, paper, rag, twine, orange peel, matches, rubber, tin foil, shoestring, paint rag, 2 pieces of a shirt, Greater Yellowstone, and around the Great Basin, people eating cattail pollen, bulrush seeds, raw baby birds, cooked ducks and geese, antelope, squirrel, beetles, chub, and suckers. 10,000 years of living, thousands paleo human droppings in the Lovelock Cave. Great tall wood rat heaps, shale flakes, beads, sheep scats, flaked points, thorns piled up for centuries, placed under overhangs, caves and cliffs. At the bottom, antique fecal pellets, orange, yellow, urine amber, shreds of every bush that grew 8,000 years, another rain, another name. Cottontail boy said, "Wood rat makes me puke, shitting on his grandmother's blankets, stinking everything up, pissing on everything, yucky old wood rat, makes his whole house stink." Coyote says, "You people should stay put here, learn your place, do good things. Me, I'm traveling on." Okay, well, that's the spirit I want to bring to this. And now I want to get serious. There's science to be done. I've been collecting rocks the last day and a half, and I've been gratified to find that some of them seem to match the pictures in my book. As a geologist, I'm a pretty good botanist. But I have identified some of the rocks that we see around here, and I also have some sense of how they arrived at this destination and when. And I want to try to impart some of that and also give you a little sense of the shapes that the rocks have formed and some of the climatic consequences of that. And we'll talk about plants and animals. I will talk about plants and animals in subsequent sessions for those who want to stay with me. First of all, we have a lot of gneiss around here, and this was the nicest gneiss I could find. The nice thing about this gneiss is that you can actually see some granite inclusions stuck right in here. This is pretty much unmetamorphosed granite, but it's been cracked and split under whatever conditions of pressure and heat metamorphosed the rest of it. Gneiss can be formed in two ways. One is through the remelting, or at least partial remelting and pressure on granite. And the other is it can come from sedimentary rock. And without a microscope and more knowledge of mineralogy than I have, you can't tell the two apart. And in the field, they look pretty much the same. I'm told that most of the stuff we've got around here is actually of a sedimentary variety, but I don't know. There is granite right in the middle of this gneiss, which as Thoreau once said of circumstantial evidence, well, some circumstantial evidence is very plain, as when you find a trout in the milk. Well, we found granite in the gneiss, so I'm thinking maybe that's where it came from. This is a heavy rock, so...
Could I identify and lift it?
Yeah, sure. I'm going to pass it around. So everybody gets to look at it and lift it. I want you to look, when I pass it around, at the planes where the minerals have lined up. This has become stratified, and there's been sort of an alignment of some of the different minerals and crystals in here. And then there's also the undifferentiated granite here. And the granite is the lighter colored spot without the striping that you'll see in the rock. And mostly this is quartz and feldspar. And you'll see lots and lots of gneiss around here, and you'll also see a lot of granite. And
Let me tell you a little bit about how it all got here from one of these overheads. There we go. That's in perfect focus, right? Okay, the geologic map of the state of Washington comprises a number of different regions, and these regions, for the most part, were cemented on to the old continent. The main portion of the North American continent is very old rock. You may have heard of the Canadian Shield, and that is some of the oldest rock that we know of. There's older rock in Australia, I think, but it rates pretty high. And it's called these continental, the old rocks that form the kernel of the continent are called cratons. What happened over a period of tens of millions of years was that continental plates shifted. I'll explain briefly the idea of plate tectonics. This was an idea that everyone laughed at early in the century, and it was put forward by a German who was not a geologist. He was very clever, but he didn't have respect within the geological profession, and so he had to argue long and hard before finally people came around to his way of thinking. And it wasn't until after World War II, when they did so much seafloor mapping, and they were able to see how the magnetic polarity of the seafloor basalt shifted back and forth over time, that they verified the idea of continental drift, or what we now call plate tectonics. The Earth is composed of maybe a dozen plates, big ones, that are in motion. And they move 2 or 3 inches per year in one direction or another. Some of them are spreading apart. Some of them are more or less static at the time and are colliding with others. And what happened to form our state here is we've got this old North American continent, and all of the rest of this was stuck onto it. And actually, some of where we are right now has fossils, marine fossils, that are found nowhere else on Earth except in Southeast Asia. So there was a hot spot in the Pacific Ocean where basalt came to the surface. It formed a very big island, and it, at least part of it, went in the other direction, but the rest of it came our way. And I won't go through the sequence of all of these things that got stuck on, but the Cascade, this says Northern Cascade Subcontinent, all of this got stuck on at one point, maybe 80 million years ago. It was down near Baja, California. But it came up, it collided with the North American plate, and then it sort of smeared on up all the way into British Columbia and got cemented onto the rest of it. And while it was doing that, there was a complex process going on. What happens with these plates? Commonly, is the continental plate is made of lighter material than the ocean basalts. The ocean basalts have more heavy metals in them. Continental plates have lighter elements. You might not think of granite as being light, but it is lighter than basalt. Basalt and other things in the mantle come from deeper in the earth. They're deeper in the earth because they sink lower, because they're heavier. And so when these things come up, onto the surface, and they're moving out from a mid-Atlantic or mid-Pacific ridge, a mid-ocean ridge. They get pushed this way toward the continent, but when they hit the continent, because the continent is lighter, they go underneath it. And when they go underneath it, if there's anything floating on top, it gets scraped off. Sometimes it's just marine sediments. The Coast Range in California is made up almost entirely of sedimentary rock, limestone, sandstone, shale, siltstone, that sort of stuff. But if there's a big thing like the North Cascades microcontinent rafting over here on this plate, it's going to smash in here, and it's not all going to go down underneath. And this is called a subduction zone. On the west coast of North America, we have a very sharp line because we've got this Pacific plate riding underneath. And so the water is quite deep, very close to the coastline here. You go out to the eastern North America and you know that it's shallow for hundreds of miles out there. That's because it's moving in the other direction. Here you get this trench, this subduction trench. All right, so North Cascades microcontinent is colliding here and cementing on to what was already established. And that's where we are right now. And the rocks that we've got here formed probably 220 million years ago on the other side of the planet. Now, since then, of course, we've had a lot of things happen. One of the other things that happens when you've got the subduction of this ocean plate is that you get this comes in at a 20 to 40 degree angle. And so it doesn't dive right straight down and melt again. It dives underneath the continent and melts. And then it comes up again in the form of volcanoes. That's why we have these stratovolcanoes, that means they're tall, in from the coast. So in Washington, it's Mount Baker, Glacier Peak, Mount Adams, Mount St. Helens. You go down to Oregon, it's Mount Hood. You get farther into California, other mountains. Oh, please, yes.
This is another question.
Yeah.
What's the white stuff below the picture? What is it composed of?
Which,
what is all floating?
Oh, down here. Oh. It's denser material, and what's underneath the magma? You know, I don't have my geology text with me.
Is it liquidy or is it?
It is. It is, but it's fairly stiff. It's thought now that the Earth is a solid core of iron, but between that solid core and the mantle here, it's speculative about what exactly this consists of, and it's really speculative for me. But this is basically floating on top of that. We know when things come from deep underneath, what we get is there's a lot of metals, and there's a special kind of igneous rock called serpentine, and a number of different forms of that, but it's very heavy in things like nickel and iron, and it's poison to plants. There are only very few species that can stand it, and some of them grow only on serpentine and nothing else does. They're called serpentine endemics, but that's another story. So, basically, there are three kinds of consequences of subduction. One is the Coast Range, such as in California, and extends up into Oregon. Another is the arc of volcanoes. And the third is, well, Mount Shasta is another one. The third possibility is what's called a granite batholith. I'm not lisping. A granite batholith. Bathyl means deep, and lith means rock. So it's deep rock. And the granite is composed of the same stuff as pumice, basically. It's mostly quartz and silica. But it cools and hardens underneath the ground, deep in the rock. And so it has time to form big crystals. And that granite batholith is what forms the Stewart Range in Washington, for example. And the granite you see around here is the same kind of thing. This is rock that comes up in association with volcanic activity, but it doesn't burst onto the surface. The last big event where we had that kind of light material, that silica-rich material, was Mount St. Helens. And I have been out, I was out there about 10 years after the eruption, on the pumice plains, and this pumice is just this light, bubbly, frothy glass, basically. It's just glass. That's what silica forms. Which is like granite that's been shot from guns. But for the most part, it doesn't get to the surface because it's very thick, and it doesn't move quickly enough. The pressure isn't great enough to squeeze that out of the gaps in the earth. It's only when you have a cataclysmic event like the Mount St. Helens eruption that you get that kind of material spread out on the ground. But you do have these great batholiths and these granite peaks, and we're actually very rich in those things in this vicinity. There are a lot of peaks. Bonanza Peak is an example of one. And actually, they're not made of granite for the most part. They're made of gneiss, like that big rock that I... Has it got around everyone?
Yeah.
Everyone that wants to lug that rock has had a chance.
Don't throw that.
I'll be better. So those are the basic geological processes that are affecting our landforms around here and have for...
Was there anything particular wrong with the copper here?
I'm not enough of a geologist to tell you why we got, why we had a rich vein of copper in this spot, but it's certainly related to that, the granite batholith and probably the metamorphic activity that followed it. Yes?
Did they used to make pennies in this area?
No, I don't think so. Most of the pennies get made in Denver, Philadelphia.
I know, but pennies used to be made in copper.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, did they take the copper and make them into pennies?
They didn't make it here. Actually, one of the reasons this...
Did they take them to Denver or something?
Yeah, that's what happens. One of the reasons this mine was only good for 19 years of operation is that this place isn't very close to anything, and you know they had to get all of this ore out of the mine, and there's no smelter around here. They don't, no place to melt that copper out of the rock, and so they had to move lots and lots of rock by railroad or barge, and once the best copper was gone, it just didn't pay. So they do all that somewhere else. All they did at the mine was take out the ore and leave a big mess. That's an interesting point. The reason that it is a big mess is that the minerals in rock contain a lot of sulfur, but it is closely bound to the rock formations until it's crushed. And once it's crushed and water percolates through it, then that sulfur is oxidized. You get sulfur dioxide, you get sulfuric acid. And it's the sulfuric acid that then begins to break down the rock and to leach out the metals. And the metals are what's really toxic. You've got zinc and copper and lead and arsenic, all of those things that then run into the streams and create the terrible problems. It's not that mountains are innately acidic. It's that once you crush these rocks and leave these leach heaps out there, you get the problems. I want to show some slides. I think I've yakked about geology enough right now. I'm going to show some slides. I'm going to talk a little bit about the weather. And then I think we should have a discussion for the time that remains. Are there any questions at this point? Or anybody have anything to add or correct? Yes?
Could you just briefly describe how a granite or an ice batholith forms a mountain like Bonanza?
I'll do my best. Yeah. When there is a collision of plates, in this case, you didn't have things butting head on. For example, the Himalayas are formed by the collision of the Indian subcontinent with Asia. And at that point, Asia's not going anywhere. So that force just pushed things up. You could try it at home with the right kind of material. Even take a piece of paper. You'll see what happens. But in this case, you've got a little bit of lateral pressure, but for the most part, it comes from below the ground, and what you've got is that upwelling of magma. And it's pushing things up. There's a huge amount of magma and a great deal of pressure, and everything is striving for equilibrium. And the way that it's going to achieve that is by trying to punch out a hole somewhere. And so it pushes up the lighter material above it. And eventually, the basalt and the sedimentary material erodes away because it's not as persistent as the granite. And that's why you get these beautiful exposed granite peaks. And I've got some pictures of that in the slides. And it's probably the best explication I can give of that. Okay. What we've got here, well, first of all, I just wanted to establish my credentials for the doubters. I really did work for the railroad. This is the Proviso Hump Yard, west of Chicago. This car is rolling down the tracks by gravity into the classification yard. There's 69 tracks. I know every one of them intimately. That's Leon. He is one of the best people, as well as the most skillful engineers on the Chicago Northwestern Railroad. I wish he could hear me say that now. This is another railroad. It's Denmark. This just shows that I couldn't fake the whole thing, because I never went to the railroad in Denmark. We're making a transect. A transect is just a line across something. And we're starting at on the west coast of Vancouver Island. We're going to be moving east from there, dipping south here and there, but basically we're moving from west to east. And this is a rufous hummingbird. It's a male, which has these markings on the tail. And they make that display. It's aggressive. It's an aggressive display. Hummingbirds around that feeder were like vermin. There were more than two dozen most of the time in the summertime in Vancouver. Okay, this is the Olympic rainforest. This is the Quinault Basin. And you really can't tell how big this is, so I've got the next picture for scale. That's a Sitka spruce. We don't have Sitka spruce around here. We have Engelmann spruce. And I'm leading nature walks, and I'll show you where the Engelmann spruce are. They're all over the place around here. Engelmann spruce don't really grow in western Washington. They're an eastern Washington thing, except, say, in Mount Adams and high elevation. So this is the Olympic rainforest. That's a big leaf maple. All those horizontal branches are festooned with spike moss and lichen and other epiphytes, which are plants growing on top of plants. And it's been found that they actually, that the tree sends out little adventitious roots. That's roots that don't come from a normal place. And sucks nutrients out of some of that mass of organic material that collects in the crotches of the branches. And of course, they have, what they get from the tree mostly is space to grow. Plants compete for all kinds of things, and space is one of them. This is also the Olympic rainforest, just another time of year, and that's big leaf maple. I was camping. It was great. An action shot, the deer accommodated me by scratching his chin. That's a West Coast deer. For those of you who are from East, we call them mule deer, or sometimes black-tailed deer. This is a lot of slide alder, and this is an avalanche zone. And that bear was hanging out with its cubs. Cubs are really fun to play with. I'm kidding. Nobody ever can play with a cub. This is vine maple in flower. And this is in western Washington. I haven't seen vine maple around here. So there's two of our maples. What we do have around here, if you see anything that looks like a maple, it's a Douglas maple, a Rocky Mountain maple. That's what's growing around here. But we're still making our way. It's slightly out of focus. Still making our way east. This is Salal in bloom. This is gathered commercially for floral arrangements. People get permits from the Forest Service, and they go into the woods and they get this. It's generally immigrants recently arrived who get paid piecework. And any leaf that's not completely unblemished and perfect gets rejected and gets taken out of their weight count. But there it is in bloom with these urn-shaped flowers, which is typical of the Heath family, of which it's a member. And this is a trillium, our native trillium, one of our native trilliums, which has flowered a while ago. Salmonberry. These were all taken in the same spot, more or less.
Is that edible?
Yes, the salmonberry is edible. Some people think it's delectable. I think it's insipid, but it's a matter of taste. And this is sword fern in the spring. This torrent is from the Kitsap Peninsula in western Washington. And I could say more about the weather at this point, but I think I'll just get through the slides and see how much time is left. And this is a chum salmon. or dog salmon, making its way upstream to spawn. Chum salmon don't jump very high. Chinook are the best jumpers, leaping. And before all the dams went into the Columbia River, they used to go all the way to Idaho, practically. Columbia doesn't go to Idaho, but tribes do. They go up the Columbia with the Snake, and the Snake into Idaho, or they go up into the Colville Indian Reservation area. And once the Grand Coulee Dam went in, the Colville, whose culture was entirely centered around salmon, was wiped out. Fish no longer made it up to their lands. And there's a salmon that's done its duty. This is Deception Pass area. This is a shore pine, and this is a western hemlock with those droopy branches. These are not native. They're native to Turkey, actually. It's a wonderful book about tulipomania. At one point, things got so nuts in the 17th century that an entire shipload of cargo was paid for a single tulip bulb. It was the dot-com of its day. Well, there they are. This is the Skagit Valley. This is in the floodplain of the Skagit River, and it's silty soil. This has been dredged and diked, but there is some natural floodplain area working in Skagit still. Well, all of a sudden we've gone from sea level to 7,000-8,000 feet. We're into the enchantments, and this is granite if ever there was granite, and this is probably an old white pine, it's escaping me. It's called Krumholz vegetation, which is German for crooked wood. And in the alpine zone, the conditions are extremely harsh, and something that's on the north face is going to be battered and frozen, and it's going to keep its branches low to the ground, and it's going to turn away from the source of the stress. And so we get this peculiar shape of this tree. What's left of it is a consequence of living under those harsh conditions. This is the enchantments. You have to get a permit to go in there now, in the North Cascades, in the Alpine Lakes Wilderness area. And this is the Stewart Range, this huge granite batholith. This is not a volcanic peak. There are no volcanoes associated with this. Certainly it's the result of a lot of hot rock coming up from under the ground, but there aren't any volcanoes directly associated with this. So this is that other example of what happens when an ocean plate is subducted and comes back up in another form. The yellow trees you see here, this is the fall, and these are conifers. This is a deciduous conifer, a larch. And there it is a little closer. A lot of people will say, well, is it a coniferous or is it deciduous? And sometimes it's both. So it's better to say evergreen and deciduous. That way you've got two mutually exclusive categories. And there's the larch in close-up. We're now, we've leapfrogged over where we are. We're in the Okanagan Highlands now. And actually, this is the lowlands of the Okanagan Highlands. There is an example of this blooming right next to the...
What's that?
The VC. Yeah, right next to the dining hall. There's the columbine. This is the lady slipper orchid, and the place was lousy with them. And this was right near in Winthrop, Washington, in the Methow River Valley. Don't say Methow, say Methow. This is another orchid. Oh, by the way, yeah, this is an orchid. You probably knew that. And this is another one. This is the fairy slipper. It blooms in the spring. It's quite delicate. It's quite small. Those things are no taller than a pencil. Calypso bulbosa. The Calypso orchid.
There's a group of those on the Copper Basin Trail.
Oh, nice.
As you head just over the first lip of the canyon into the beginning of the avalanche zones, just right along, about a foot off the trail.
Is it blooming right now?
Yeah. As of last week.
It's good.
We were up there today and it's still blooming.
Well, I'm going to lead a hike to Copper Basin on Saturday, I think. Oh, this, I like this. I like this for many reasons. This is bitterroot, and the root actually is edible. The genus is Lewisia, and it's named after Meriwether Lewis, who was a hero if ever there was one. Unfortunately, a troubled man, probably bipolar. He took his own life while he was still in his 30s. And this is Clarky. And it is named after William Clark. This is Clarkia pulchella, which is pretty Clarky. It's an annual. This thing grows up from seed every year. By now we're in the Colville National Forest, so we're east of the Okanagan now, and continuing to move east. These are two friends of mine who are both employed by the University of Washington Department of Botany, just up on the top. I put some people in so you wouldn't think that I was completely nerdy about plants. This is a penstemon, and there are a couple of species of penstemon that are planted. I saw the, I recognized them, but I also saw some markers for some that weren't in bloom. This one, I think, is penstemon rupicola, but it's growing up in the, we're up at about a mile high in eastern Washington. Now we're into Montana. This is the Beaverhead National Forest in western Montana, and what we're looking at here is penstemon as well as cat's ear or mariposa lily, or also called sago lily. Well, and there was my colleague on this rare plant survey amid the mariposa lily and scarlet gilia, which this is it. There are two or three dozen species of this plant across the western United States.
Is that the mariposa?
Yes, that is. And this is the scarlet Gilead.
How do you spell it?
G-I-L-I-A. And there's the penstemon that we were looking for. This is a rare plant in Washington, although it's much more common in Montana. I'm sorry, it's a rare plant in Washington, in Montana. We found it, though. Oh, and that was one heck of a storm. Just after the storm in Montana. This is Big Sky country. I had to put Big Sky in. Actually, this a big difference in the climate out there than here. And the reason is we've got this line of north-south running mountains. And our weather comes from the Pacific Ocean, mostly. Or it occasionally comes from north. But most of our winter storms come from the south, throughout Washington. And we don't have the influence of the Gulf of Mexico and that tremendous contrast between heating and cooling in the center of the continent. It doesn't happen to us. It's moderated by the ocean, which has a huge capacity for absorbing heat. Okay, now we've gone a lot further east, and this is not a natural landscape. This is Denmark. And we have a field of what we call canola here. It's in the mustard family. It's also known as rapeseed. And over there is rye. And this is just a weed grass. This is not rye, sticking up above all of the heads of rye. And we've arrived in Sweden, north of the Arctic Circle. And here the landforms are quite obvious. There's no greater pleasure than reading a topographic map in a country like this. Every little curve and line is instantly apparent. You know exactly where you are. There's a much younger man than I am. And there's the picture he took from that point at midnight. All right, weather. I'm going to wrap it up at 7:20. And I'm going to talk just a little bit about how the mountains influence our climate. These are called isoclasts. Iso means same. You know, isobar is something that shows what the barometric pressure is. Well, these just show where the rainfall is. And we have one of the steepest rainfall gradients on Earth, right here in the Northwest. These things are not quite in focus, but it tails off sharply as you go from west to east. And you get a huge amount, 100 inches of rainfall here. This doesn't quite go far enough because it's only showing the Puget Sound region, but it's down to 15 here. In a distance of 80 miles, you go from 120 inches of rainfall annually to 15, which is not quite desert, but getting there. And there's a tremendous vegetational contrast as well. And the reason for that is the mountains. Why do mountains catch rain? It's because of something, there's a Greek word for it, but I won't inflict it on you. As you get higher, gases expand. And as they expand, they release energy. It's the same principle that your refrigerator runs on. You squeeze the gas, used a compressor in order to squeeze out that heat, squeeze out that energy, and then when it runs through, circulates through the cooling tubes, it pulls all of the heat out of the inside of your refrigerator, and then you have to squeeze it again to get it out. Well, the same thing is happening as you go higher in elevation. That's why it gets colder. For every 1,000 meters, or for every 100 meters, rather, you lose a degree of temperature. And eventually, you're going to be quite cold at the summit of Mount Rainier. That cold temperature at the tops of these mountains, these big landforms, intercept the warm, moisture-laden clouds, and they cool them off, and they cause them to drop their rainfall, because at a certain temperature, the air can only hold so much water. When it's hot, it can be very humid. When it's very cold, it's going to be dry. So all of the rain falls on this side, and it's much drier over here. And that's all...